Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's tax day, and you've got until midnight tonight. Every year we do this, count the dollars and cents, file, and hope for a refund. But how much do you really know about American tax policy and who pays? This hour On Point, Tax Day and the Future of American Tax Policy. You can join the conversation. Are you ready? Already filed? Scrambling? What are your thoughts on this country's tax policy? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first this hour from McLean, Virginia, with an update on this year's tax season is Sandra Block, personal finance reporter for USA Today. Sandra, welcome to On Point.
Hello, Jane.
So explain why this year the tax deadline was extended to today.
Well, that is a fluke of Washington, D.C. In Washington, Emancipation Day is a holiday, and when it falls on tax day, then the IRS can't accept returns. This year, Emancipation Day, April 16th, fell on a Saturday. So since that's already a day off, everybody got Friday, April 15th off, so they delayed tax day until April 18th, which is today.
Got it. So tell us how many Americans will be filing taxes this year.
I think we're running about same as last year. So far this year, I think usually within the last couple of weeks, about 75-80% of people have filed. Mm-hmm. So what we're looking at right now is maybe the last 20%. And through the beginning of April, the IRS had received about nearly 90 million individual tax returns.
And how many extensions might be filed?
Well, typically about 7% of taxpayers file for an extension. That's automatic as long as you don't owe. So about 7% of taxpayers will ask for an extension, and that will give them until October to file their tax return.
And how many people owe, and how many might be getting a refund?
Typically about two-thirds of taxpayers get a refund. Most people end up, and I think that's just a product of withholding. Most people have more withheld from their taxes than they owe. And this year, the average refund is running about $3,000.
Mm. What about these tax assistance centers, Sandra, that the IRS has set up this year? Have they been helpful?
They are helpful to people who can find them. There was a Treasury watchdog report that came out a couple of weeks ago that said that the assistance centers haven't really kept up with demography in this country, and that a lot of people live more than 50 miles away from a tax assistance center. If people are wired up, there are more resources than ever, I think, online. So I think there are a lot of opportunities to file and get good advice. The IRS website is actually pretty good. So people who have access to the Internet actually can get a lot of help that way. But the tax assistance centers are helpful if you can get to one, but for a lot of people that's not the case.
Unless we forget, the IRS accepts credit card payments, and this year you can set up a payment installment plan if need be.
That's always been the case. The problem with credit card, you can put your tax balance on a credit card. The problem is that unlike a credit card you use in a store, the IRS doesn't eat the processing fee. So whatever you owe, you're going to end up having to pay an additional 2% usually. Mm-hmm. It depends on which processing center you use, on top of your balance to cover the third-party processing system. So it can be kind of expensive.
Are there tax deductions this year that might be helpful for some of us to remember, moving expenses, student loan interest, job search expenses?
Those are all, I think what particularly so many people have had, had a difficult 2010, and people do need to realize that they may be eligible to deduct the cost, as you mentioned, the cost of searching for a job. In some situations, there are some limits on that. The IRS won't give you a deduction if you're searching for a job outside your field, but you can deduct the cost of searching for a job. You can deduct the cost of moving if it is job related. So those are there. And as you mentioned, interest on student loans, which many people have. If people have questions about whether they're eligible and worry that they're not going to get all the deductions that they maybe do, I would really encourage them to file an extension, because that will give them more time to make sure that they're not shortchanging themselves.
Extension or otherwise, always file a tax return, because if you don't, the penalties are very harsh.
That's right, and that's a really good point. People don't realize that the penalty for failing to file is much higher than it is for failing to pay. So if you file, even if you just file your tax return and don't give the IRS any money, you're in much better shape than if you just try and hide, because that's when penalties really start to accrue. Mm.
Sandra Block is personal finance reporter for USA Today. She joined me from McLean, Virginia. Sandra, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Joining me now from Rochester, New York, is Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author David K. Johnston. He's a columnist for Tax.com and author of the bestsellers Perfectly Legal, The Covert Campaign to Rig Our Tax System to Benefit the Super Rich and Cheat Everybody Else, and Free Lunch, How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expense and Stick You with the Bill. In 2001, at the New York Times, he received a Pulitzer Prize for exposing tax loopholes and inequities. David K. Johnston, welcome back to On Point.
Well, thank you for having me, Jane.
Let's go through some of the tax realities of our day that you've written extensively about lately. I want to start with this notion that the wealthy are paying less taxes. How much less? Is it true? What do the numbers show?
Well, the top 400 taxpayers, there's an annual report done on them by the IRS since 1992. In 1993, the first year of the Clinton administration, paid just under 30 cents out of each dollar of their income to the federal government in federal income taxes. At the end of the Clinton administration, they were down to 22 cents. At the end of the Bush administration, well, we only have the data from 2007, not 2008, they were down to 16.6 cents. And notice that of this more than 40% reduction in their tax burden, from 30 cents down to less than 17, the larger share came under the Clinton administration. Well, we think of Bush as a tax cutter and Clinton as a tax raiser. At the very top, it's Bush was not so beneficial to those at the very top as Clinton.
So the less, so the wealthy are paying less taxes. I read in one of your piece where you said
they're paying less as a share of their income. Their incomes are exploding, so
I
the total dollars are up.
Okay. And what about unemployment insurance taxes and Social Security and Medicare, all these payroll taxes? They're paid mostly by the bottom 90% of wage earners. Is that true?
That's exactly right. The Social Security tax stops at $106,800, which is about 83% of workers make less than that in salary. And the Medicare tax applies to all wages. The highest wage earners in America in 2009 were 72 people whose, as measured by the government, wage and bonus came to more than $50 million. I think the average was 80-some million for each of those 72. Now, if you get your income from capital, dividends, rents, interest, royalties, and a lot of things executives do as well as hedge fund managers do, your income is treated as capital, not compensation, even though it is for your work, and you pay at a maximum 15% rate, and generally you will pay not now but years or decades from now.
So there's a snapshot of the highest wage earners. Let me ask you about corporations these days. The story is much the same, isn't it? They pay less in taxes?
Yes, and it's principally at the very top. But both the individual income tax and the corporate income tax, when you look at the actual taxes paid, have the same effect. When you get to the very, very top, tax rates fall off sharply. So corporations with between $5 million in assets and $250 million, those are good-sized companies, but they're not household names. Mm-hmm. Are paying taxes, paid taxes in 2008 at 32%. The official rate is 35. But the 1,900 biggest corporations, those are the household name companies, who control almost 80% of all corporate assets, their real tax rate was under 20%. Mm. And so the same thing happens with individuals. Once your income gets above $10 million, your income tax rate starts to fall. Once you get over $100 million, it collapses. And there are people who make billion-dollar-plus incomes with no current tax liability. There have been until recent years. We don't have the data yet for 2008-9.
So essentially, when it comes to corporations, first of all, you're telling me that the American mom-and-pop operations essentially bear a tax burden nearly equal to the mega corporations in our country.
Well, mom and pops generally are not organized as corporations, but if they are, yes, absolutely, that's what happens. Now, I did a column at tax.com recently showing that General Electric, which the New York Times did that huge front page piece about by my successor, about how they didn't pay any taxes in 2010, and Forbes had reported they didn't pay any in 2009, their average cash paid tax rate for the last 10 years was 11.8%. The New York Times cash paid tax rate for those years was 71%, more than twice the posted rate. And that's because the New York Times bought the Boston Globe and some other properties in a way that does not allow them to deduct for tax purposes the goodwill that they acquired.
So there's a huge disparity among taxes that are paid among the biggest corporations as well. How often does that happen? I mean, there's the New York Times and the General Electric example, but how often do you see that?
Well, I think the New York Times is a clear outlier on the far end. On the other side of that, though, General Electric is, like some other big companies, the beneficiary of incredibly intense lobbying. Last year, GE spent $73,000 per senator and congressman to lobby, $73,000 each. And then in addition, of course, all the reasons that they would have connections with people at the top because of their enormous economic power. And they have had a bunch of provisions stuck in the law in various places that benefit GE.
What about the poorest among us, the poorest Americans? How has their tax burden in this country shifted?
Well, low-income people who are single pay substantial income taxes. If you make $33,000 and you're single, the government takes 10% of your pay. Low-income people with children generally don't pay income taxes, but that doesn't mean they live tax-free. You know, you hear this thing all the time, half of Americans aren't paying any taxes. Absolutely false. The bottom half of Americans pay local taxes, income, payroll taxes of 15.3% on their first dollar, sales taxes, all sorts of other taxes.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking about American taxes on this tax day. David K. Johnston joins me today. He's a columnist for Tax.com and a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author. He's giving us a snapshot of taxes today, who pays what, and how much. Let's go back a little bit, David, to the poorest Americans among us. You were explaining to us how much they pay at the bottom with gas taxes and sales taxes and utility taxes and other taxes. Truth of the matter is that many poor Americans don't make enough to even pay federal income taxes.
That's right. The federal income tax starts at $9,350 for a single person, $18,700 for a married heterosexual couple. And the average income of the bottom 50% of taxpayers, and I know some people are going to be shocked when they hear this number, but you can go to the Tax Foundation website and do the math yourself. The average income of the bottom half of taxpayers is $15,300, which is less than $300 a week. Now, that's market income. It doesn't include things like disability benefits, Social Security if you're a low-income senior.
Based on your analysis of the numbers, you say when it comes to state and local taxes, the poor bear a heavier burden than the rich in every state except for Vermont. How do you figure that?
Well, the Institute of Taxation and Economic Policy did that analysis, but there have been other ones done. The tax lawyer and theologian Susan Pace Hamill put out a thick book on the same thing and came to the same conclusion. The extreme example is Alabama, where the poorest fifth of families who make less than $13,000 a year pay state and local taxes of 11% of their income. That's about $120 a month. And the richest 1%, which in that state is only $229,000 and above because Alabama is a poor state, they only pay they pay less than 5% of their income. So the poor bear more than twice the burden of the top earners in Alabama, and they bear a heavier burden in every state but Vermont because of the regressive nature of taxes that are paid by the poor. We all pay these taxes, but sales taxes, excise taxes, property taxes, et cetera.
So, David, in the midst of all these numbers and statistics, I just am curious if you would level it out for us and tell us what Americans should take away from these numbers and statistics tax day today.
Well, my conclusion about this is that for 30 years, we have been trying this experiment called supply-side economics, that if you reduce taxes on capital and people who are the highest earners, that you will have a broad general prosperity. Reagan told us that would happen. George W. Bush very much argued this. The fact is that the average income of the bottom 90% of Americans, that's almost all of us, for every dollar people made in 1980 per taxpayer, they now make $1.01 when you adjust for inflation. There has been no gain, $300 more per year in 2008 than in 1980. But at the top, it's an entirely different story. Incomes have exploded. The top 1% overall, and the top 1% starts in six figures. It's under $1 million where you start to enter that group, under $500,000 actually. They have almost $4 for every dollar they had in 1980. And on top of that, since 2000, the population of the country has been growing at five times the number of jobs, and the median wage, half make more, half make less, has been stuck now for a decade at just over $500 a week. And my conclusion is this policy does not work. We've now got 30 years of data. It doesn't work. And we can show that, in fact, periods long back, the website Presometrics has good examples of this. There are periods when raising taxes leads to more economic growth, which seems totally counterintuitive, but there are good reasons for that.
Let me get a caller in here, David. Kate is on the line from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Kate. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call.
Of course. Go ahead.
I'm just really frustrated and angry that the middle class is shouldering the brunt of the tax burden. I work two jobs, a part-time job to get my benefits, and then the rest of the hours I work per diem. And this year, I paid like 5% of my overall wages in taxes. And it's because I guess I'm single and I also don't own anything, so I don't get the tax breaks. But it's so frustrating and it's so unfair. And we have all these, you know, really good idealistic people doing great work, and then we get, you know, pummeled by taxes, and then the rich are just, you know, skating free. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Kate, thank you very much. David K. Johnston, there's Kate. She's working a couple of jobs, making not a lot of money, and as she put it, and as you write in your pieces, many of the very richest Americans pay no income tax at all.
Right. But let's be clear, people at the top 1%, do pay significant taxes. The most heavily taxed people are those who make between about $100,000 and $1 million. It's the total burden of taxes we need to be talking about, not just the income tax. And we certainly should not have a system in which you can take in millions, tens of millions, hundreds of millions, even more than $1 billion and pay no current taxes. That's an outrage that we need to stop. But it's not going to stop so long as the dominant voice in Washington are the political donor class, the people who have money to lobby and to make campaign contributions and to arrange jobs for the relatives of our elected leaders and for those elected leaders who are either voted out or retire.
Let me bring another voice into this conversation, David. Joining me from Washington, D.C. is Douglas Hulse-Aiken. He's president of the American Action Forum, a policy think tank in Washington, and former director of the Congressional Budget Office. He was chief economic advisor to John McCain's 2008 presidential campaign. Douglas, nice to have you back to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
What are you hearing in David K. Johnston's analysis of taxes in America today?
Well, I think that, you know, the facts are very nearly as he's described them. And we have an income tax, which is disproportionately paid for by a small number of high-income Americans. For the vast majority of Americans, their largest federal tax are payroll taxes into Social Security and Medicare. And then there's a variety of state and local taxes that everyone's going to pay and bear that burden. I think the most important thing that's missing from the fairness discussion is the fact that there's also things coming out of the federal government. And for many Americans who are paying into Social Security and Medicare, the vast majority will get out much more than they'll ever pay in. So they're going to be subsidized by the income and payroll taxes of the remaining Americans. And that means that the income tax is really paying for all of government. And that means that most people are being given their government by a small handful of Americans in the top 5 and 1%. So there are a variety of angles you can look at any fairness argument, and you know, tax day always brings out a fairness debate.
Let me ask you about supply-side economics, because David K. Johnston is saying essentially that supply-side economics hasn't worked over the last 30 years, that this theory of lowering tax rates on the wealthy to encourage more investment, which will in turn mean more jobs and greater prosperity, it hasn't worked. Ronald Reagan embraced it, as did George W. Bush. What's your take on this? Supply-side economics, has it worked? How do you see it?
I think it's an extremely narrow lens to look strictly at taxes and economic performance. The purpose of a tax code is to raise money to fund government programs. And the goal of a tax code should be to do that with the least damage to social norms of fairness and to economic activity. That's it. There's nothing good about tax policy from the perspective of economic growth. It's trying to minimize the bad news. And because so many other things can drive economic growth, you can get some very strange relationships between taxes and growth. Take the late 90s, for example. We had a dot-com bubble, and as a result, even with higher taxes, we saw what appeared to be lots of economic growth. We saw lots more revenue flowing into the federal treasury. It was only after the bubble broke that we realized it was largely illusory and that the revenue was going to disappear in 2000, 2001, 2002, and that the growth would disappear as well. So there's nothing about a tax code that creates or stops bubbles. They come from other parts of the economy.
With so much talk about deficits today, if we do lower taxes to some extent, do you anticipate seeing a bolstered economy, Douglas?
I don't think there's any tax cuts on the horizon from either side of the aisle. The only debate is whether it's useful to raise taxes, especially now in the near term. And from my perspective, the real lesson there comes from the President's Fiscal Commission, which says the route to more revenues lies through tax reform. We do have a system which is badly broken. There are too many loopholes. There's lots of inefficiencies. The tax code shouldn't be picking winners and losers. So a broad-based tax reform that raises the revenue we have now or more is what we need in the future.
Broad-based tax reform, David K. Johnston, do you agree?
The one key area where Doug and I disagree, and Doug is an economist and I'm not, but I generally agree with his description of things. You know, we need to have, for example, a Social Security system where, adjusted for inflation and economic growth, you don't get more out than you pay in over time, for example. And we need to address the fact that we need fundamental broad-based tax reform, because the benefits of the 86 Tax Reform Act have been completely undone through lobbying and special interest provisions over the years.
Let's get a call in here. Danny in Buffalo, New York. Hi, Danny. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me. So I actually had a slightly different point. I know a woman that works in one of the local schools here. She's maybe a secretary, I believe. And she's been working for years trying to get a master's degree in psychology. And then she finally got her master's degree, and she realized that if she were to start working in psychology, she'd get a much higher wage, but because of taxes and a lot of benefits that she would lose, she would end up actually losing out in the long run, and she'd actually be hurting herself financially. So it's one of the problems that I have with the tax system nowadays, that you can work harder, and then as a result, you actually end up with less money. I think that's a really big problem with the American system, because we supposedly really believe in hard work and we want people to be working harder.
Danny, thank you. Douglas Holtz-Aiken, would you respond?
Well, I think the reality is that Americans have a fundamental belief in progressive tax systems. I mean, you hear lots of talk among conservatives about flat taxes, but we've never seen any broad-based support. We believe that those who have a greater ability to pay should pay more. We also believe that in helping low-income individuals and then phasing out that help, both of those features mean that as you make more money, you get things taken away, and that looks like a tax on your progress upwards. The goal then should be to, you know, rework this system so it's done in a rational fashion and one that is transparent and understandable. What happens more often now than we like is people are baffled by why their tax status changes, and it looks capricious and unfair to them.
David K. Johnston, how do you respond to Danny, the caller, saying his friend is working harder, trying to bring herself up, move herself along, and really sees herself as being punished for that?
First of all, Danny says something I hear from people all the time. It is simply impossible and not true. He said she'd make more money and be worse off. There is no 100% tax rate. In all likelihood, his friend, the secretary, is in the 15% tax rate. So if she gets a raise of $1,000, instead of paying $100, if she were in the 10% rate, she would pay $150, or if she goes to the 25% rate, $250 in taxes. She's still way ahead on the $1,000. In the worst of those cases, she still gets $750. So you're never worse off for making more money, except for the very, very poor, because of anomalies in the way our system is set up. But fundamentally, we want to have a system that encourages people to save, to invest, to play by the rules, to be strivers, and that distributes the fruits of the American economy in a fair and reasonable way. One of my main points has been that we've adopted government policies that are redistributing income upwards and are concentrating power, wealth, political power and wealth at the very top, and forgetting the ancient principle that was involved in giving birth to democracy, the moral basis of progressive taxation.
Here's another call from Michael in Clarksville, Tennessee. Hi, Michael. Welcome to the program.
Hello, Jane. Thank you for having me.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Well, the biggest comment I want to make is, you know, I don't think people realize the wealthy of a society are wealthy and successful because the society allowed them to be that way. You know, Bill Gates, he's wealthy because people bought computers and they liked Windows. I mean, if they had, you know, if the populace had liked Linux more, you know, we would be using Linux. But you know, movie stars are wealthy because people go see their movies. And whenever you have that, the distance between the wealthiest of people and the poorest of people, it's so far apart. Like it seems we're approaching to now, the French Revolution. That's kind of what happened.
Essentially, the rich getting richer, poor getting poorer. Michael, thank you, David K. Johnston.
Well, Michael's actually hit upon the area where I think Doug and I have the biggest disagreement. I believe that taxes are the foundation of wealth because there is no wealth, at least legitimate wealth, earned wealth, without civilization. And it is the investments of civilization in an infrastructure, in courts to adjudicate disputes, in a military to protect assets. And in the case of Bill Gates is a great example of this. All of the money, our tax money that was spent developing mathematical algorithms, that's what software is, material science, that's what chips are, and related things led to these fortunes. And when you look at the society, you need to recognize this principle, and Michael's quite right. That's the principle the Athenians figured out that gave birth to democracy, that there is no legitimate wealth without Athens. The greater the wealth you manage to attain because you live in Athens, the greater your moral obligation, therefore the heavier your tax burden, to support Athens so that it will endure.
Douglas Holtaken,
the key issues are, fundamental philosophy. Does the state have the right and the appropriate tools to redistribute wealth as it is created in this society, or is that something that belongs to individuals and which only through a voluntary compact do they permit a government to tax? And that's a debate that has gone on since the beginning of time. And there's a more practical issue at play here, which is if you look at the rising inequality in the United States and elsewhere, it's fundamentally driven by differences in skills and education. And this is not something that can or will be closed by tax policy. It is something that can only be addressed by recognizing that, by and large, the U.S. K-12 education system is failing about half of its students, largely in large inner-city school districts, and that this is an injustice of the most fundamental sort and a competitive disadvantage for the country as a whole. So, I'm a tax economist by training. I've spent my whole life talking about taxes, but there are some things that are not about taxes, and we need to fix the skills problem in the U.S.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about taxes today on this tax day. David K. Johnston is with us today. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, author, and columnist for tax.com. His best-selling books are Perfectly Legal and Free Lunch. Douglas Holtz-Aiken is also with us. He's president of the American Action Forum, a policy think tank in Washington, and former director of the Congressional Budget Office. In 2008, he was chief economic advisor to John McCain's presidential campaign. Here's a little sound now. Last week, in a speech at George Washington University, President Obama laid out his plan to reduce the deficit by $4 trillion over the next 12 years. He spoke of the need to raise taxes on the wealthiest of Americans.
Some will argue we should not even consider ever raising taxes, even if only on the wealthiest Americans. It's just an article of faith to them. I say that at a time when the tax burden on the wealthy is at its lowest level in half a century, the most fortunate among us can afford to pay a little more. I don't need another tax cut. Warren Buffett doesn't need another tax cut.
And here is Meet the Press this Sunday, where Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner told host David Gregory that the wealthy should pay more taxes to support social programs.
The way our tax code is structured, and it's a broken tax code, we spend hundreds of billions of dollars a year on special tax expenditures, special tax breaks that go to just the top, the wealthiest Americans. So we have plenty of room in this tax code that will result in just a modest increase in the burden on the most fortunate. And if we do that, then we can afford to, along with other spending cuts, we can preserve the commitments we made to our seniors, to the disabled, to the poor.
Douglas Holtz-Aiken, this is Obama administration has been hitting on this theme over and over of raising taxes on the wealthiest of Americans. Do you see that happening this year?
It's not going to happen this year. It's unfortunate, I think, from a number of perspectives. Number one, the focus on taxing a few high-income Americans more heavily distracts from the larger problem of the federal budget, which we're seeing vividly today when S&P announced a shift of the long-term outlook from the U.S. from stable to negative, and markets are down 200 points. I mean, we have enormous debt problems. The administration's own budget raises taxes on the rich and still runs a deficit of $1.2 trillion 10 years from now, $900 billion of that's interest on borrowing. So by focusing so heavily on that part of the puzzle, they're actually getting in the way of solving the larger issue, and that's, I believe, very unfortunate. The second thing is that we need tax reform, and if you raise taxes on a few individuals, you're getting in the way of the basic goal of fundamental tax reform. So I think the emphasis politically should be put there and raise more revenue in the process. We have to pay our bills. At this juncture, I think this has been an unfortunate turn. I mean, they campaigned on this in 2007, 2008. When we got to last December, they didn't go through with it. They extended the tax cuts. I think it's time to drop this. It looks more politics than real.
David K. Johnston, is there broad bipartisan support for tax reform? Is it doable this year?
Not so long as the position of the Republicans is no tax increases for anybody anywhere at any time. That's simply not going to happen. And if you look at the Ryan plan, I'm actually very grateful that Congressman Ryan has put out his plan, because he's made it very clear what he and everyone who's supporting him agrees is the number one problem in America. The rich don't have nearly enough.
Douglas Holtz, Aiken?
I guess I don't see that. What I see in the Ryan plan are a couple of things that we've said were a good idea, which is a comprehensive tax reform, which looks just like the president's fiscal commission: lower the top rates, broaden the base, get rid of the loopholes, and make the tax code more efficient. It also takes on the Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, Affordable Care Act entitlement programs, because those are the source of the debt crisis that's looming. Those are also programs that are all running red ink, and as a result, will not survive to the next generation. And so it seems to me a great injustice to take the social safety net for the poor and aged, leave it on autopilot, and let it crash. Now, you may not like the Ryan solutions to that problem, but I think taking them on is an imperative, and if people want to weigh in with alternative plans, that'd be fine.
David?
Let me suggest that there's a different way of looking at this. We decided in this country, beginning with President Reagan and PATCO, to destroy unions and take away from individuals the right to bargain collectively, or the effective right to do so. And guess what? The wages of people who don't – all the education in the world is not going to change their lives. Blue-collar workers, unskilled workers have gone down. We have adopted government policies that told manufacturers, you should move your operation to China. This is not – the classic notion of free trade in Adam Smith. This is a labor arbitrage. Move jobs to China, make the same goods, send them right back to the United States. Those have driven down the wages of ordinary Americans through government policy. We can solve our federal budget deficit if we simply solve our health care problem. We're spending 18 cents out of every dollar in our economy on health care as a business instead of running health care as a service the way we do prosecutors' offices, fire departments, police departments. If we ran kindergarten the way we run health care, every school teacher every day would fill out a form saying, I gave 6 green crayons to boys, 4 red crayons to girls, because that's what doctors do all day at enormous cost, and we've created this for-profit business.
Well, a lot of pieces to this puzzle, David.
If other countries can afford this, Jill, who may have less income than we can do better.
I've got calls around the block. Let's get to a few of them. David is in Orlando, Florida. David, welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Don't you think the failure of supply-side economics, I don't consider it a total failure, biggest part is the explosive growth in local, state, and federal government. They refuse to downsize, just absolutely refuse. And they don't care about how much money they bring in to match the size. It's all about we're going to expand as much as we want. And then the second thing is Americans aren't making as much in certain levels because they don't have the education, like your guest said. And the third is globalization. We have done a lousy job opening up markets. We cannot get into Japan. We can't get into South Korea. We can't get into China. Those three countries absolutely refuse to allow majority of what we make into their country. Raw materials, the exception, which they can turn around and send back. But those three things really hurt supply-side economics.
Glad you called, David. Thank you. Here's another David in Franklin, Massachusetts. Hi, David. Welcome to you.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call.
Uh-huh.
So my comment is regarding education specifically, and what Mr. Holtzakin said about the fact that it's outside of tax policy, whereas I think it's absolutely within tax policy, where the only way we're going to have a better educational system is to devote more resources to it. If we don't fund education properly, if we don't fund teachers properly and teacher education, that takes more money. That takes more taxes from the country to be able to develop a better education system. They always talk about we need a better education system, but yet they don't want to put their money where their mouth is and actually provide the funding for it. So there's no way we're going to increase our competitiveness unless we are better in our education system, which means devoting more resources to it. I could be a very good English teacher, but I would have to take about a 50% to 75% pay cut. So I'm not going to do that.
David, thanks for your call. Appreciate your thoughts. Here's Candace in Marshalltown, Iowa. Hi, Candace. Glad you waited. Thanks for calling.
I'm a daycare provider, and I charged, you know, my parents a certain amount. And then when I did my taxes, I ended up getting more from my taxes than I did from my income. So, and I was in the poverty level in the tax bracket. So I don't really understand why there's such a deficit.
Candace, thank you. David K. Johnson, would you respond?
Well, I'm assuming either that Candace got a refund because she paid too much money during the year and basically loaned money to the government that got back without any interest, or she's under the earned income tax credit because she's a very low-income person, and we have this Milton Friedman idea put in place by Ronald Reagan of a negative income tax so that people who aren't working, if they go to work, don't face a 100% plus effective or marginal tax rate, which under which nobody in their right mind would go to work.
Thanks for the call, Candace. Here's Bruce in Durham, New Hampshire. Hi, Bruce. Welcome to you.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I wanted to turn to a great Republican leader for some tax guidance, and that would be Dwight Eisenhower. I think that the marginal tax rates under Eisenhower were in the 80s or even 90% for the very top earners. It was a time of robust economic growth, and it seems that our top income earners of today could pay rates like that and still get by on the millions of dollars a year that they're making. I think it could be a good thing for everybody.
Bruce, thank you very much. Back to the future, Douglas Holtzakin, what do you think?
Well, as a matter of political likelihood, I don't see it. And I think it's important to recognize that the world has changed radically since the time of Dwight Eisenhower, and one would think your economic policies would as well. Post-World War II, the U.S. had very little competition in international markets. It had the ability to really exploit its near monopoly power in sales around the globe. Since then, we've seen lots of competition emerge. We are now losing, in many cases, the companies that would provide exactly the jobs that would generate millions for the owners and good benefits and wages for the workers. They're headed overseas, in part because of our tax policies, which have, you know, not really accommodated the competitive pressures. So I don't see that happening as a matter of political likelihood. I also don't think it's probably the right recipe at this point in time.
David K. Johnston, your view.
I agree with Doug. We no longer have the position we had coming out of World War II with more than half the world's industrial capacity. On the other hand, the rules of trade have been written by the financier class, and look who has benefited from it. Overwhelmingly, our economy's gone from 16% profits of all profits coming from finance to more than 40%. And our policies, I believe, when looked at in full, and my next book will go into a lot of policies no one, no academic, no journalist has ever written about that are right in the public record that I believe are driving down wages and redistributing income upward.
Let's go to Nashville. Allison is on the line. Hi, Allison. Welcome.
Hi, Jane.
Hello. Go ahead.
Well, my comments after, you know, listening to all this, and this is something that we argued when I took Economics 101 at Vanderbilt in my college days, but I honestly think we ought to scrap the entire tax system and institute a flat tax on all income, earned and unearned, for individuals and corporations. No exemptions, no loopholes. 5% on individuals, I'd say 10% on businesses and corporations. It would be a fair, and it'd be all across the board.
Douglas Holtz-Aiken,
would
it work, Allison's plan, a personal corporate flat tax? Allison, I'm glad you called to bring it up. No exemptions, no loopholes. What do you think?
There has never been, in my view, real support across the American population as a whole for a flat tax. Americans do want those who have a greater capacity to pay more. We've always favored progressive systems. There have also been a variety of taxes called flat taxes or fair taxes, specific proposals, and we've seen those actually brought into the political debate, and none have ever gained traction. So it's the dream of many people to have a system so simple that you can see it and undertake it that way, but we'll never get the political traction for it.
The Bowles-Simpson debt plan actually suggests tax reform that lowers rates and broadens the tax base, but closes all loopholes. I mean, David K. Johnston, what do you make of that? And how do we do that, all these loopholes and exemptions that are written into our tax code?
Well, that's the your First Amendment right to petition your government for a redress of grievances. Some of us, just through contributions, have much more rights as a practical matter. The problem with the flat tax is it ignores marginal utility, which I hope Allison also learned when she was taking Econ 101. $1 more to someone who makes $1 million a year is meaningless. For someone who makes $9,000 a year, it may determine whether they go hungry on the last day of the year. And that's why you have progressive taxes. As to the loophole business, on the corporate side, I have long said we need to have a debate about going to a single set of books, not having tax accounting for the IRS and book accounting for shareholders, but one set of rules dealing with corporations to stop a lot of game playing.
Got to get a couple more calls in from John in Boston. John, welcome.
Hi, Jane.
Hello.
I just wanted to make a comment regarding some of the recent, over the past year or so, tax credits that we've seen, such as first-time home buyers as well as cash for clunkers. I understand the purpose of them to stimulate some of those areas where we needed them. But as somebody who didn't benefit from either, basically because of timing, I wasn't going to be a first-time home buyer, and also you know, had a two-year-old car, so I wasn't ready to turn it in. I just feel like, you know, being caught in that middle, that there's never anything for everybody. That it's, you know, it's always targeted to specific groups, and, you know, being a middle class, I also, you know, I'm starting to see that as well with kids going to school, where you get the tax breaks for the colleges if you're below a certain level, and also scholarships and what have you. But being just about dead center where I am, it just seems like we don't do anything but give and give. Mm-hmm. So I just wanted to make that comment. Thank you very much.
Glad you did, John. Thanks so much. Douglas Holtz-Aiken and David K. Johnston.
I think those particular policies are just junk. On their merits, I think they have little to support them. And they're reflective of a bigger problem, which is the adoption by both Republicans and Democrats of this notion that we can fine-tune the economy through taxes and spending programs. We've done it in 2001, 2002, 2003, 2005, 2008, 2009, again and again. And if you go back to the 60s and especially the 70s, that was the economic mindset of that era, and it didn't work. We should get a tax code that we believe in, stick by it, and stop the fine-tuning. It's not working.
David K. Johnston, I'll give you the last word.
Absolute junk. I agree with Doug about that. I think that we do need to recognize that taxes is the biggest single piece of the economy, are fundamental to our society and our economic growth. They provide the foundation for private wealth building, so they're very important. But stuff like credits for buying houses, which is a giveaway to the real estate industry and the bankers, and the car cash for clunkers deal as we designed it, which was for temporarily push forward in time sales of cars, that's just nonsense and pandering. And we need to get away from that and get to fundamental, broad approaches to our taxes.
Well, thank you very much, Douglas Holtz-Aiken, joining us from Washington, former director of the Congressional Budget Office, president of the American Action Forum, with chief economist to John McCain's 2008 presidential campaign, and David K. Johnston, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author, columnist for Tax.com. He's author of Perfectly Legal and Free Lunch. I'm sure you both have filed. I have. Thanks very much for your time in the midst of a very busy day. I appreciate it, gentlemen.
Thank you.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. Listeners, thanks to you. This is On Point.